The full power of the gospel of Jesus Christ is contained in the Book of Mormon, period.
Remember this declaration by Jesus himself. Whoso treasureth up my word shall not be deceived. And in the last days, neither your heart nor your faith will fail you.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 197 of the Book of Mormon podcast. As always, you have Kevin and Shelby here.
Hi, everyone.
And this week, we are taking on the first chapter of the Book of Mormon. And that's not 1 Nephi chapter 1. That's actually a book within the Book of Mormon called the Book of Mormon. Kind of confusing at first. But what's interesting about the books within the Book of Mormon is that we are hearing from the principal authors of each book. And it's actually kind of interesting. I wanted to make it a point, and it's actually addressed in the first verse of this first chapter. It says, "And now I, Mormon, make a record of the things which I have both seen and heard, and call it the Book of Mormon." And in my margins, I wrote a little note. I said, the Book of Mormon is a record of primary sources, i.e. first-hand accounts. And we can track that all the way back to 1 Nephi, where Nephi actually talks about, you know, making a record with his own hand in the language of his father, you know, which was the language of the Egyptians, and so on and so forth. So, you know, again, it builds upon that authenticity, and, you know, we discuss it occasionally about the Bible having changed hands, being translated so many times. Some of it was an oral history that was then written down or passed on for generations, but all of these accounts are first-hand accounts. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I want to talk about what the name Mormon means, and it's in the Book of Mormon Student Manual. It says that the name means more good, which if you think about the Book of Mormon, it is more good in the world today. The actual book and the actual book that we hold in our hands titled the Book of Mormon. So more good is always good to have.
Yeah, that is really cool because we call the Bible the good book. Mm-hmm. So we have more good in a second good book.
And then what's the gospel of Jesus Christ?
It's the good news.
It's the good news. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Very cool. Well, we are going to dive right in because a little disclaimer. We've made a couple of attempts to record this episode about this first chapter. The first time we sat down, we had internet difficulties.
Which, that was crazy. That was literally insane. I can't even explain to you. We sat down. We were like a minute in. And then we notice little things not uploading correctly. And we pause. Only to find out that one of our cables to our house, there's two cables that run to our house. One was broken. It like cut off on the 28th or something. But we had just found out the week we recorded. It was insane. Anyway, it got fixed. But I just have to say that was wild. We've never had that happen yet.
Yeah. And then the second time we were just having difficulties. We weren't meshing. We didn't really agree on the approach that we were taking to the podcast. But it had nothing to do with the podcast. It had to do with other things going on.
You know, we always say that having the Book of Mormon podcast is really good because you can't come to record a podcast together when you have things going on that you haven't talked about. Mm-hmm. And so it's just important to have, you know, little weekly check-ins like that. And that was the second attempt we made. And it didn't work. We stopped about 12 minutes in. I said, I don't like this. Kevin said he didn't like it either. And so we we talked it out. And now we're here. Third time's a charm. I'm so hopeful. So nevertheless, we're going to dive in. We already talked about verse 1. Kevin, why don't you take us away? Which I think Kevin has a disclaimer for us, too.
Oh, another disclaimer to this episode. is that because we've studied it multiple times, every time I go back, I get more and more out of it, like more of these gold nuggets that I draw out from the chapter. So, you know, I'm not going to be able to talk about everything that I've learned. And so I'll have to save it for the next time through, the next time through the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about another thing that starts in verse 1 and continues throughout the next 3 verses. And it talks about the things which I, Mormon, have both seen and heard. And that was an admonition from Ammaron, who he was the descendant of Nephi, who received the records, you know, throughout the years following the visitation of Jesus Christ in the land Bountiful. And he received them, and then I guess he didn't necessarily have anybody to hand them down to, so he hid them up. Well, Ammaron then comes across this young boy, Mormon. He comes across him when he's 11 years old is when we pick it up. But you never know. Maybe Ammaron, wait,
he was 10. Sorry.
Oh, 10, excuse me. Yes, I being about 10 years of age.
Yeah.
And that's when Ammaron comes to him and talks to him about this record. But it's possible, you know, just throwing it out there, that Ammaron maybe observed him for a little while and noticed, like, hey, this kid is, he has this aptitude, or, you know, and he talks about that aptitude. He describes it as being quick to observe and being a sober child. And another thing that I have to put in there is that by this 10 years of age, Mormon explains that I began to be learned somewhat after the manner of the learning of my people. And goodness, if that is not a thread that you can pull through all of the major record keepers and authors of the Book of Mormon, all going right back to Nephi in 1 Nephi, making a record of the language or in the language of my father, and then Mosiah chapter 1, all 3 sons of Mosiah, or King Benjamin rather, who are taught in the language of their fathers, that thereby they might become men of understanding, that they might know concerning the prophecies, and so on and so forth. And that takes us, and then I'll stop talking for a little bit. That takes us to an adjacent concept or principle, which we find in Alma chapter 5, verse 6, which is when Alma asks the brethren, the members of the church, have you sufficiently retained in remembrance the captivity of your fathers? Yea, and have you sufficiently retained in remembrance his mercy, the Lord's mercy, and long-suffering towards them? And moreover, have ye sufficiently retained in remembrance that he has delivered their souls from hell? And so it's not just worldly learning that we're talking about. It's also that spiritual learning and, I would say, testimony or witness of the prophecies. And so that is also part of this learning of the fathers that Mormon is doing as well.
I just want to remark on something that you said, that he may have, Ammaron may have observed him for a while. I also think it could be the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. Because I've had moments, especially when serving with the youth, where I just meet youth, and I just know that that youth has a special talent or just has what to call it, but you can tell that they have something different about them and that they are doing the things that they should be. And so you're able to identify that. And I think, you know, given the society that Mormon grows up in, it probably wasn't hard to distinguish people like that. Because we'll see that Mormon didn't really grow up with ideal circumstances, right? The things that he sees and he observes for the record. So just wanted to point that out.
I guess in the idea, the point there is that we may not know.
Right.
But I think both are valid.
Well, of course, theories, I was just getting another idea.
Yeah, but I that's what I'm saying is that I like that idea too, because yeah, definitely, you know, my experiences with the youth as well, you come across these youth that
they shine.
Yeah.
They shine a little brighter. Anyway, that's not to say that the rest are not children of God and loved. It's just these ones, you can tell they're rising to their calling.
Oh, yeah.
And they're enrolling in the youth battalion that President Nelson asked them to. Okay, so back to the verse 3. He asks Mormon, when he's 24 years old, to obviously remember all the things that he's observed about the people. And then he's going to go to the land Antum, onto a hill, which is called Shim. And that's where Amaron hid up these sacred records. So when he's 24, he's going to go and he's going to do that. And he's going to obtain these things.
Yeah. But just to clarify, he should remember the things that he has observed concerning this people, which I think is important to put in there because, you know, he's not being charged immediately with the record. He's being told that, hey, when you come of this age, that is the time that you'll go and retrieve the record. But in the meantime, you need to exercise this skill of yours, this aptitude, which he describes it as being quick to observe, and use that. So we've talked a little bit in previous recordings of this episode that it's likely that he probably kept a journal himself, right? Some sort of record, personal record. I mean,
in order to remember.
Right. It talks about, if you go back to the Book of Mosiah, it talks about how, you know, Lehi could not have remembered all of the things. And so it was expedient that he needed to write them down, which meant that they had to retain their language and keep that language consistent throughout time, which is another thread that I have to pull there, which is the difference between the Nephites and the Lamanites. The Nephites retained a remembrance of the Lord their God, the captivity of their fathers, and specifically a language that they could record all of these things. The Lamanites seem to either not have done that, or, you know, oh, it actually talks about their language being corrupted. I don't know the verse or chapter off the top of my head, but it does talk about their language being corrupted. And at that moment on the podcast, I drew that connection as well. Like, hey, they didn't have the pure testimony, the truth of their history. And so the misconceptions, the lies, the twisted narrative, right? Let's see. Oh, Omni chapter 1, which is the only chapter in the Book of Omni, 17 and 18. That's a little reference that you can go and read. Shel, do you have anything to add there? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not trying to correct you, but I do know that some of the language was corrupted because they never had the scriptures in the first place, right? So like the brother of Jared, we know, we'll get into this because we're coming up to him. They didn't take records with them and their language was corrupted. And there's also another group who also did not have records with them. And so that's also how their language became corrupted. And then you have the people who broke away, right? Nephi and Lehi, like you were saying, and then also their language is corrupted. So there's many ways that a language can be corrupted and many scenarios when you don't retain sacred records, right?
Yeah.
And the ancestry. And especially when you're being fed a narrative that you were wronged and you should have been in Jerusalem the whole time. Like, of course, mm-hmm. you're not going to want to look to God because you're being fed a different narrative. And that's just not, it wasn't what happened. Mm-hmm. Right. So anyway, at this point, he says that when he gets to this hill, he's going to take the plates of Nephi unto himself, and the remainder he's going to leave where they are, which indicates to me that there's more things there, right? There's more things in the plates, but he's going to leave everything else there. And then he's going to take the plates of Nephi, and he's going to then deposit everything he observed on these plates about these people, right? You know, over the last few years and moving forward too, we see as well. And now we get Mormon's insight here in verse 5. He says, and I, Mormon, being a descendant of Nephi. So I think it's really cool. This is part of the remembrance and learning of the language of his fathers. He remembers he's a descendant of Nephi. And my father's name was Mormon. Right? He's remembering his lineage. I remember the things which Amaron commanded me. And it came to pass, I, being 11 years old, was carried by my father into the land southward, even into the land of Zarahemla. So he's starting from the time he was told, right? Starts paying attention at 10, and here he is giving us a record. Here I am at 11, and I am carried away south into Zarahemla by my father, who's Mormon, who he just identified. And then he gives a condition of the land, right? He says, the whole face of the land had become covered with buildings, and the people were as numerous almost as it were the sands of the sea. That's a lot of people, right? And I would say we have that numerous people today. And he also then begins to talk about a war that happened when he was 11. It said it began to be between the Nephites. And then he identifies who the Nephites are. They are the Nephites, the Jacobites, the Josephites, and the Zoramites. And then it's between those groups, and then the Lamanites and the Lemuelites and the Ishmaelites. So there is a lot of ites going on, a lot of groups identifying different from other groups. Don't know if that sounds similar to today, but it is. And so we get to see this war that breaks out. And he basically says in verse 9, just to keep it simple, the two parties are the Nephites and the Lamanites, even though within each group there's different types of ites, right? But they're coming together for one purpose, and that's to fight each other. And that war is in the borders of Zarahemla, which he just said that he was going to the land of Zarahemla. That's how he knows this is happening, right? He was in the borders of Zarahemla by the waters Sidon. So yeah, we get a little movement of where Mormon is, what he's doing, and what he's seen. Do you have anything to add about those verses, Kevin?
There is one thing that is addressed when he talks about how in verse 4, Amaron says, you shall take the plates of Nephi unto yourself, like you said, mm-hmm. and the remainder you'll leave. That's specific, mm-hmm. and important, because remember that on those plates, or as in the scriptures, it talks about these plates that we're reading off of right now, those were the spiritual matters of the people. You have the large plates, which were the secular history, or the history of the wars and such of the people. And we get some of that, you know, intermingled in the small plates here. But that's kind of setting Mormon up to be a spiritual leader. And I think observing and really focusing on the spiritual decay mm-hmm. that he witnesses. And I actually want to jump to the following chapter, Mormon chapter 2, where he kind of throws back and talks about this. He says, and upon the plates of Nephi, I did make a full account of all the wickedness and abominations. But upon these plates, I did forbear to make a full account of their wickedness and abominations. For behold, a continual scene of wickedness and abominations has been before mine eyes ever since I have been sufficient to behold the ways of a man, or of man. So, and we'll get to it very quickly when the war begins. That's seems to be the focal point of Mormon's remembrance, is the divisions of the people and then the war that is resultant.
And this first battle that he sees at age 11 in Zarahemla is a big battle. It says there's 30,000 right in this battle. And they had a number of battles. It wasn't just one. And the Nephites did beat many of the Lamanites. So the Nephites definitely had, I don't want to say domination, but they were winning, right, in these battles. And that forced the Lamanites to withdraw. It says withdraw their design. And this is what created the peace settling in the land for 4 years. So that puts him at age 15. For the 4 years having no bloodshed. However, that doesn't mean that there wasn't wickedness.
Right.
So this is verse 13. Okay. So he says, so that battle's over. Here's what's still happening. But wickedness did prevail upon the face of the whole land, insomuch that the Lord did take away his beloved disciples, and the work of the miracles and of healing did cease because of the iniquity of the people. I'm going to read one more in 14. And there were no gifts from the Lord, and the Holy Ghost did not come upon any because of their wickedness and unbelief. Okay, so I have something to say about these verses. I'm sure Kevin does too. But even though there wasn't physical battles going on, there's still mental and spiritual battles to be won. And we can see clearly that wickedness is still prevailing. And because they were so wicked, it's because of the iniquity of the people and because of the unbelief and the wickedness that they're partaking in, that the gifts are gone, the Holy Ghost is no longer there, and disciples are gone. That is why it's taken away. It's not because the Lord doesn't love them. It's not because God doesn't love them, right? It's because of their own choice to engage in wickedness, that they are no longer privileged to have the Holy Ghost, any gifts that come with that, and disciples to lead them. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important thing to see here in the Book of Mormon, because most recently in General Conference, in the past few General Conferences, I felt like it's been made very clear that you are choosing what kind of life you want to live here and after this life. And this principle here rings true to that, that these people are choosing what they want to do, but their choices do have consequences. And that's important to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. To provide some scriptural backup for what my companion is testifying about, we go to Mosiah chapter 29, verse 27. It says, and if the time comes the voice of the people doth choose iniquity, then is the time that the judgments of God will come upon you. Yea, then is the time he will visit you with great destruction, even as he has hitherto visited this land. It's important to note that at this time, before the destruction, the Lord did take away his beloved disciples, and that work, the miracles, and of healing did cease. I want to also read a cross-referenced verse, two verses from Helaman chapter 13 and 14. It says, but blessed are they who will repent, for them will I spare. But behold, if it were not for the righteous who are in this great city, behold, I would cause that fire should come down out of heaven and destroy it. But behold, it is for the righteous's sake that it is spared. But behold, the time cometh, saith the Lord, that when ye shall cast out the righteous from among you, then shall ye be ripe for destruction. Yea, woe be unto this great city because of the wickedness and abominations which are in her.
Can I add something?
Yes.
So we just talked about this on the way to the temple today. Mm-hmm. I brought up this exact principle that it's because of the righteous that the judgments are spared from the people right now. Now, there comes a point where it's too late and destruction does come. But like the analogy I like to use, because I love airplanes, is I had this analogy in airplane one time, because if you haven't already heard our podcast, I have an irrational fear that a plane is just going to go down and it doesn't make sense, right? Laws of gravity, all the things. But I had this moment on airplane one time that really made me understand this analogy. I know he gave the example of the city, but I think of a plane, right? When people are defying the laws, the plane can't be held up anymore, like in my brain. And so, but if there's righteous people, covenant-keeping people on that plane, or people who are trying to do good and follow Jesus Christ, they don't even have to have made covenants yet, but just good, righteous, desired people on that plane, the Lord's going to spare it a little longer, Jacob 5 reference, to hopefully convert some people on that plane and keep that plane up in the sky so it can get safely to its destination. Right. But if at the point when there's only one left and everybody is just given way to whatever, well, that plane's going to come down and it's going to be destroyed. Right.
Right.
So the righteousness keeps that plane up, or in other words, the city, right? It keeps it from being destroyed at this time.
Right. To kind of unpack that, I think, because
it's not the best analogy, but it's an analogy that Shelby understands.
Right.
So I thought I would share it, and maybe some of you might understand.
Sure. So, just to unpack it, you're saying that if there were, you know, several righteous people on a plane,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of the majority of them are wicked, mm-hmm. and something were to cause the plane to become compromised, mm-hmm. the Lord would, you know, move upon the plane to, mm-hmm. you know, get it to safety, but it's for the righteous' sake. It's,
right.
It's, you know, in spite of those wicked people, the righteous are kind of propelling it forward, you know, mm-hmm. preserving it, or the Lord's preserving it, but it's for the righteous' sake. I get that.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that in these verses, the Lord takes away his beloved disciples, but Mormon's still there, right?
Yeah, and we do know from verse 15 that Mormon, he says, quote, "I was visited of the Lord and tasted and knew of the goodness of Jesus."
Right.
So we know that he's not withholding from those who have righteous desires. Mm. It's just not going to the people who are so hard-hearted and wicked. You know what I mean? Because they're choosing. They won't even let it come in.
Right. That's what we get in verse 16. Before we get there,
mm-hmm.
talking about the willful rebellion against mm-hmm. God,
Mormon.
Yeah, Mormon, he says, "And I did endeavor to preach unto this people, but my mouth was shut."
Mm-hmm.
Now, at first you might think, but why? Right? Well, the Lord is taking away his disciples, not only maybe to protect them, but also, you know, he's ensuring a righteous judgment, right? He's saying, hey, I'm going to kind of stop up, you know, there's no longer going to be this liberal flow of prophecy and revelation among the people because they're no longer willing to hear it. They've chosen iniquity.
Go ahead.
And I was just going to continue. He's forbidden to preach, for behold, they had willfully rebelled against their God, and this because of their iniquity. It reiterates that.
So I was going to say, like, you're reading this and you're thinking, oh, well, but Mormon's there.
Mm-hmm.
But what was Mormon's calling? What is his calling? What was he ordained to do, right? He is the one that hides up the record and compiles the record. Mm-hmm. That's why he's being preserved. He has another mission on the earth. So the Lord can't take him. But is the Lord going to just abandon him because everybody else is being wicked? No, he is faithfully fulfilling his calling. Mm-hmm. And this is why he is being visited. But he doesn't have, his calling is not to go preach. That's already been done and been tried, and it's not working, right? So Mormon, your calling is to focus on observing these people. Your calling is to hide up this record when the time comes. It's going to be a lonely one. We know he's alone, but it is such an essential divine mission that Mormon took on so that we could have the Book of Mormon today. And that's why Mormon was preserved and not any of the other disciples preserved, right? We had to have gotten the plate somehow.
Yeah.
So I just thought about that right now. Like, why? This is why. Pretty obvious, but I thought I would state it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as we near the end of the chapter, in verse 17, it talks about that, it says that Mormon remains among them.
Mm-hmm.
As we discussed, he's forbidden to preach. He says that again. And because of the hardness of the hearts of the people, the land was cursed for their sake. Now, this is interesting that we get this occasionally, this cursing of the land. Now, the curse is a withdrawal or a withholding of the Holy Ghost. The miracles of God can no longer be performed. No, they no longer exist among the people. This does a bunch of things. One of the things that it seems to do here, it kind of facilitates, and I say that in a kind of weird way, I guess it gives opportunity for the Gadianton robbers who were among the Lamanites. They begin to infest the land in so much, says in verse 18, that the inhabitants thereof began to hide up their treasures in the earth, and they became slippery because the Lord had cursed the land, that they could not hold them nor retain them again. Now, when I read that, I thought, what is it talking about? And then I remembered that we actually talked about this.
We did talk about this.
Yeah, it was actually in Helaman 13. And that episode was actually episode 160. And I went back and listened to what we talked about.
Hmm.
And in those verses, chapter 13, verses kind of 18 through 20, it talks about a great curse in the land. It talks about the Lord hiding up. He's actually hiding up treasures. But the cursed, they attempt to hide up the treasures kind of because their hearts are set upon the treasure and they don't trust in God. And so this idea of hiding up treasures is relying on your own strength rather than relying upon the Lord and his arm. And so, again, it's a spiritual decline. It's a loss of the spirit. It's a loss of the priesthood. And in its place is a counterfeit, right? We see sorceries and witchcrafts and magics. And the power of the evil one was wrought upon the face of the land, even unto the fulfilling of all the words of Abinadi and also Samuel the Lamanite. Which, if you want to go back and reference those words, they talk about the catastrophic destruction of the people. So, not great.
I just want to say, I know you moved on, but the treasures becoming slippery, they can't hold them or retain them. Sounds like a financial collapse to me.
Hmm, interesting.
Like they don't have money anymore. They can't, right. They can't, they're trying to hide their money, but they can't. Like and, it's gone. There's no value.
Yeah, that, and you hit it on the head, no value. So the money that they do have
doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. So to me, it sounds like a financial collapse in the society, to where now maybe they're trading and they're bartering instead with other possessions that they might have. But that's just me speculating. Don't know how true it is, but I imagine something's going on. If they don't have treasures to buy with, something else has to be happening for society to keep going.
Well, and I think it's not unreasonable to think this too, that because of that financial strife, you know, certain people are going to be like very low in status, but then the other people will be very high. And so you begin to have like this
big divide,
very large discrepancy or inequity.
Yeah. And I think that could also be a sign of the beginning of a decline of a society. Not the beginning, but somewhere towards the beginning of the end is what I meant.
Well,
and we know that the society does not survive.
Right. Well, so. And the next comes massive conflict in terms of violent conflict.
Right.
Wars in which massive numbers of people are involved in the fighting. And so.
Well, and we know that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we've referenced this before. When our basic needs are not being met, right, like food, shelter, those type of things, it tends to bring out the fight or flight mode. And that can bring emotions, right, that are like, man, I have to now kill or fight to get my needs. And that's definitely the natural man, you know, kicking in right there, trying to persuade you to do bad in that situation, whereas we can choose to do good in that situation, try to find other ways to be, you know, good disciples of Jesus Christ despite our needs not being met, and relying wholly upon Jesus Christ, right, and his arm to help us in those moments. Because there's been plenty of examples in the Book of Mormon of people who had it pretty bad. They were imprisoned, they were under a heavy burdensome tax. But they secretly prayed unto the Lord, and they did things, and they came out after a trial of tribulation, but they did come out of it. But then you get examples like right now where we're going to see the massive conflict that Kevin's talking about, of a society that just gives into the natural man and does not even heed the spirit. So.
And I kind of feel impressed, at least for me, as we study these next several chapters in the Book of Mormon. I feel impressed to really focus upon that theme of, you know, this is a people who they forsook God, they willfully rebelled, and they're kind of left to their own designs, right? Their own abilities.
It's no bueno.
And like, what is the result of that? Like, what's the result once you completely forsake God and, you know, try to reverse engineer that to say, okay, how do we get back from there? Right. If that were the case. So,
yeah,
but yeah, that's the first chapter.
It was a fun one. We got it done, Kev.
We got it done.
I'm proud of us.
Yep. Next week, obviously we're going to continue, and there's a lot actually in the next chapter. The wars that we've kind of referenced, they begin to really kick off. That heat starts to rise, and you know, we learn more about Mormon in his youth. I'm excited to learn more about that.
Yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
My dear brothers and sisters, I promise that as you prayerfully study the Book of Mormon every day, you will make better decisions every day. I promise that as you ponder what you study, the windows of heaven will open, and you will receive answers to your own questions and direction for your own life.